Welcome to the Side Hustle Project, a podcast where we explore the nitty-gritty details behind what it takes to start and grow a profitable side hustle. I'm your host, Ryan Robinson, and in this podcast, I'm bringing you interviews with entrepreneurs, best-selling authors, CEOs, investors, and people just like you who are building and profiting from interesting side hustles. In today's episode, we're chatting with John Richards, the co-founder of Nomadic, a travel gear company he co-founded with his cousin Jacob back in 2014 that now sells bags, backpacks, notebooks, wallets, watches, and more, all designed for active people that are always on the go. When John and Jacob first started Nomadic, they were both working time-consuming full-time jobs. John for an HR software startup and Jacob for his family's consumer goods company. It was while they were sitting together chatting with their wives at a Utah Jazz basketball game in their home of Salt Lake City, Utah, that the two decided they wanted to test out whether or not they could launch their own business and make a run at becoming entrepreneurs. They knew right off the bat that they wanted to make a product and had seen several brand new companies take off with this relatively new crowdfunding thing. And this was particularly appealing as you could pre-sell a product without first going through all the costly investment of actually manufacturing large quantities of your product. It wasn't long after that fateful evening at the game that the two settled on the decision to make a few prototypes for a wallet they could launch on Kickstarter. Little did they know that first crowdfunding campaign would generate more than $170,000 in sales, and each subsequent campaign they launched only grew from there. In this episode, John and I talk about how they quickly hand-built the prototypes for their very first product and creatively hit their first crowdfunding campaign completely out of the park. We dig into the nitty-gritty of how they source factories in China to manufacture their wallets, notebooks, travel bags, and backpacks, including John's best pieces of advice for replicating their success with production factories. We go behind the scenes of what it's like to raise over $2 million on a crowdfunding campaign, their exact strategies for leveraging Facebook ads to scale their pre-orders, building an engaged social following, generating hundreds of thousands of views on their YouTube channel, and more. As always, you can find everything we mentioned in today's episode in the show notes at ryrob.com/podcast. That's spelled ryrob.com/podcast. Let's get into today's interview with John Richards. John, welcome to the show.
Hey, Ryan. Thanks for having me.
I'm pumped to talk to you. And, you know, today I want to start this interview off by asking the first question that I ask everyone I have here on the show. So first and foremost, John, what book are you reading right now, or what's been a favorite of yours recently?
Oh, man, that's a good question. So one of my all-time favorite books is probably The 4-Hour Workweek. You know, I think for me it's definitely been not a 4-hour work week. It's been the opposite. We put in a lot of time here to, you know, try to be successful. But at the same time, like, I love a lot of the principles of optimizing processes and making your life a little easier that book offers. So, yeah, I would probably say that's my number one.
Awesome. I love it. So, John, you're the co-founder of Nomadic, a company that you co-founded actually with your cousin Jacob back in 2014. You guys have made a wallet, a notebook, a few different travel bags, and an assortment of other products. So can you take us back to 2013 or 2014 and tell us about what originally inspired you guys to start this business?
Yeah, so it was in the spring of 2014. We were actually at a jazz game. We were just sitting there with our wives, and we just got chatting about business. And at the time, Jacob was like, let's do something cool to just kind of test the waters with business, see if we can grow a social following around an idea. And I introduced him to Kickstarter at that point, and he said, all right, well, that's a good idea. Let's try it. And so we researched Kickstarter and found out that wallets typically fund really well on Kickstarter, and that it wasn't a pretty easy way to just get a project funded. So we said, all right, let's develop a wallet. You know, at the time we both carried bulky wallets, and we said, let's see if we can slim down our pockets a little bit. So we started designing wallets, and we were sending prototypes back and forth to each other and videos of it. And it was really interesting to see the progression of that, because it went from being just this idea to something where we would, you know, when we had the final prototypes, we were giving them to our friends and family, and watching their reactions was really cool. It was like they were totally stoked on these wallets that we are creating, and it became something where I was like, wow, I think people are actually going to like this. So we went ahead and we launched it on Kickstarter in October of 2014, and we had a goal to raise $10,000. And, you know, within the first week, we were pacing that number, and we were pretty excited. And then during our campaign, we met up with a advertising agency that helped us learn how to do Facebook advertising. And that kind of was the game changer that propelled us. So that campaign, we went on to raise $170,000 through Kickstarter. And that was like our first real success, was just funding that wallet. We had, you know, thousands of backers that came and supported us. And it was really cool to see that we had actually brought an idea to life and that there was people who were willing to pay for it.
Yeah, no, that's insane. And I do want to dig deeper into just kind of the tactics and strategies within the campaign. But real quick, how did you guys go about making the very first prototypes of the product? Were you kind of just in your garage tinkering around making them yourself? Or did you find like a product design shop to help out? What did that kind of look like?
Yeah, look, I mean, we chose a wallet, which I think we were, you know, super blessed to have chosen that product because it's super lightweight. We were using soft goods, so it was easy to stitch. And Jacob, my business partner, he actually learned how to sew in his basement. So he just got his mother-in-law's sewing machine and his 8-year-old sister-in-law came in and had just taken a sewing class and was like, here's how you do it. And he basically taught him right there. And, you know, it wasn't more than a couple stitches, but we were playing around with elastic material. So we just stitched it together and it worked. And we were really excited about how it turned out. And, So that was all just like right out of his basement. We didn't use a design firm or anything like that. And so it was a pretty cool learning experience, but we were lucky that we didn't have to do any like, you know, prototyping with plastics or metals or anything like that, because that can get complicated.
Mm-hmm. Were you guys working full-time jobs at the time that you guys were building out the prototypes and getting ready for Kickstarter?
Yeah, we were. Jacob was actually at his family's company. He was doing operations, and I was at a HR software company doing sales. And so I'd been there for about 6 months or so when we launched the campaign, and, you know, just making calls every day. And this was just consuming my thoughts. And it wasn't like 2 months later, I jumped out of that job and I was the first one to leave. And then Jacob, about 6 months later, he jumped out of his full-time job to pursue it. So it was a pretty quick transition for both of us. Within a year, we were both out of our full-time jobs and doing it full-time. But it really helped that first Kickstarter, you know, we were able to fund about 170,000 through that campaign. And so that really helped give us a little nest egg to say, all right, we're confident enough that, you know, even if this were to fail over the next year, like we have some cash in the bank that would support our families, you know?
Yeah. You basically bought yourself proof that this could last at least a little while before, you know, just gambling on an idea.
Totally.
I love that. So, you know, fast forwarding just a little bit now, you guys have these prototypes out there. You launched the Kickstarter campaign. At what point did you decide to sort of go into full on manufacturing? Why did you decide to do it when you did? And then maybe if you could share with us kind of the first steps that you took to get started with that. That's, I know it's a black box for a lot of people listening today, is just going from, you know, I can hand make a few of my products myself, but when should I take it to the next level? How do I do that?
Yeah. So originally my sister was going to sew the wallets for us. So we're like, yeah, we'll probably sell a couple hundred wallets. And, you know, if you could sew them for us, that'd be great. And she's like, totally. and then, you know, it came back and we're like, uh-oh, you know, I don't think she can sew 6,000 wallets. I think we sold like somewhere close to 9,000 wallets in our first campaign. And we did the math and it was like, there's no way, she won't have enough time. And so, you know, about halfway through our campaign, I got really lucky. So Jacob, he's my business partner. He actually has about, at the time, he had about 6 to 8 years experience sourcing products overseas. So he had already done it for his family company. They make like hair accessories for girls and sell to Walgreens and Target and Walmart, places like that. So he had some experience working with China. And it seems like such a daunting task. You know, you're approaching this separate country or something where you're trying to outsource this manufacturing to someone else. And especially if you feel like there's a language barrier, it can feel overwhelming. But for our second campaign, which was the notebook, we created this planner notebook that helps people improve their lives and focus on being productive and having gratitude. And for that campaign, Jacob said, John, I want you to source this one. And I like you say, it was kind of a black box for me. I was like, wait a minute, how am I supposed to communicate with China? And so he kind of walked me through what does that look like? How do you work with the overseas? And it wasn't as hard as I thought. And there are a few tips and tricks that maybe help some people. So, you know, Alibaba is a great resource for people to just go and look up ideas. But within that program, there's ways to use it to make it a little more efficient. And I would say a couple of quick pointers are just to, you know, try to find a factory that's been in business for a good amount of years, like say 5 to 10 years, that's got a good number of employees. So it's not just starting out fresh. They've got a good track record. You try to look in certain areas of China that where there's manufacturing, like Guangdong and Shenzhen. There's a couple cities within China that are just known for being really good manufacturing cities. So you don't want to be like too, you know, inland China or some crazy remote city that you've never heard of. So you look for those key things, and then to communicate with them, I usually would just Google their websites rather than working through Alibaba, because you often will get hit up by, you know, people trying to sell stuff to you. And so it just was, it's kind of annoying. So if you just kind of find, you find the factory basically, and then you just go to Google and you Google that factory name, and then you find the contact info. They usually have a website. And, as far as communicating goes, they use Skype a lot. And you can quickly, it's really the language barrier isn't that bad. And that's one of the things that you should look for in a factory as you're starting to source your products, is how well do they speak English? Because that's going to come back to haunt you if you don't find someone that's able to communicate. But in my experience, 95% of these factory owners, they speak English, and it's not a problem. And you don't need to worry about translators and all that kind of stuff. So those are, yeah. I mean, that's probably 4 or 5 quick tips just for people who are saying, how do I source a product overseas? Jump on Alibaba, find a few key factories, you know, Skype them or email them directly. And then you just kind of, you have to start wide, you know, start with 5 factories maybe and work your way down to that 1 or 2 that you want to end up working with. And you try to request prototypes from them and those kind of things. So there's a lot, I could go into that a lot more, but basically that's, I don't know, that's maybe 4 or 5 quick tips for you.
Yeah. No, it's all great advice. I mean, you're giving me flashbacks to a couple of previous businesses I ran, you know, spending time starting at 8 or 9 PM Pacific, when the factory in China wakes up.
Exactly.
And so you're doing funky hours, but it's cool. It's all great advice. And, you know, John, one of the things that I've found extremely impressive about what you guys have done is just the sheer amount of funding you've raised through Kickstarter, right? So you mentioned your first product, $170,000 raised for the wallet. After that, you have the notebook, $383,000, $1.7 million for your first travel bag, $2.2 million for the backpack last year. All in all, you guys have raised over $8 million in sales. So why did you choose to continue using Kickstarter to really drive your business, right? So, you know, the validation component with the wallet, that makes total sense to me. But why did you guys choose to stick with Kickstarter?
That's a really good question. Man, you know, after having experienced this whole business process, I look at other people and I look at them and I just think, how in the world could they do business without Kickstarter? We get all of our funding up front. We get, we're able to prove the concept, like you say, we're able to get our customer base. But the most important piece to me is that they're able to give us live feedback on our products that we're about to launch into the market. So what we try to do is we try to come to Kickstarter with a product that's roughly 80% finished, right? So when we get there, we say, here's the idea, here's what we want to accomplish. Now you give us feedback to let us know how we can improve it. For example, the travel bag, when we launched that one, that was our first $1 million campaign. Like you said, we did 1.7 million with that one. And that was the first time where we were like, all right, we're now a bag company, right? So as soon as we saw that funding coming in, we're like, all right, let's move away from wallets and notebooks. Like, let's focus on bags. And the biggest feedback we got was everyone was saying, why don't you have waterproof zippers? And we hadn't even thought about that. And we surveyed our backers, 99% of them wanted waterproof zippers. So we're like, all right, let's make a change. So we did. And so it's just little things like that where it was like, we didn't think through the process, and having those people that give us that feedback is invaluable. I don't think there's any number you can put on that to say, you know, other people, what their process is, they build it out, they do all their focus groups before and try to figure out what customers want. And then then they launch it to the market. But they've also had to put tons of capital up front to try to buy the inventory to have it in stock. Mm-hmm. It's just huge. It's a huge investment and it's really risky. Whereas Kickstarter kind of takes all that risk away and it proves the concept. It gives you your customer base up front and then you get the cash before you even have to manufacture, and your customers are willing to wait, you know, 4 to 6 months to receive the product. So it's pretty amazing.
I agree. I'm sold. you mentioned earlier that at least with the first campaign, but I would actually imagine with all of your campaigns that paid Facebook ads have driven a lot of your early pre-sales through Kickstarter. So can you just give us kind of a rundown, maybe how you eventually tested your way into clearly perfecting this into kind of a repeatable system?
Yeah. So Facebook is an interesting beast. It's, you know, Google has been around for long enough that it's kind of stabilized. Facebook is still pretty volatile and it's growing popular very quick, which means the cost per clicks are rising very fast. Within the last year, we've seen our cost per click almost double on Facebook, which for us, you know, like you said, it drives 70 to 80% of our business right now. It's really slowed things down for us when it comes to just driving sheer traffic. So the good news is Google has actually started surpassing it in our volume, because we've started making these higher priced products like our travel bags and things that we can sell. And Google has started to become a lot more popular for us. But in the early days, Facebook, it was like printing money basically. I mean, we would spend, you know, $2 on Facebook, $1 to $2, and we'd make 20. So it was like, it was just like as much money as we could put into it. You know, in our first year of business through just the wallet, we did $2 million in sales through Facebook advertising. And that's just wow. One product that's a $20 price point. And that, I mean, for us, that was huge, right?
The ad was basically 10% of what revenue was.
Yeah. Basically around 10% of that was the cost of advertising. And so it was, I mean, that's 4 or 5 years ago now. So now we're looking at it and there's no way I can make a $20 product work. Even a $50 product is tight. These days, like, you pretty much have to be selling over $100 product if you want to make Facebook advertising work. And that's one of the main reasons we've levitated towards these higher priced, high quality bags that we're selling now.
That is fascinating. So, you know, you also mentioned diversifying your acquisition sources, right? So Google being a new traffic source for you guys to generate sales. What else is working today?
We're testing a lot of new things. We're starting to mess with influencers. So this is kind of a rising market right now, is this whole influencer marketing where people are posting for you on Instagram, and trying to crack that code has been proven to be really difficult, harder than we thought it was going to be. But I think it's going to start playing big dividends in the way that people feel about our brand, as far as who we work with and who's posting for us, those kind of things. So, you know, I would say that's one channel. So you've got the paid media, which, you know, Facebook, Google, Bing, and Instagram, that pretty much is where we push our dollars as far as paid ads go. And then as far as other channels, we do quite a bit of that influencer marketing where we're sending out free product in exchange for posts. And, you know, there's some paid media that we're doing where, you know, we're trying to capture different gear websites or things that talk about bags, and peer reviews on YouTube are huge. So there's a ton of channels that we're trying to push right now. But as far as just driving traffic, Facebook and Google still account for, yeah, probably 70 to 80% of our daily traffic right now.
Do you guys do the outreach yourselves when you're reaching out to, say, an Instagram influencer or a blogger, or even these, you know, gear sites that have lots of established readers? I get the appeal of going in that direction. It makes a lot of sense. But it's not a super scalable channel necessarily, right? Are you doing this outreach yourself? Are you emailing them? Are you going to the, you know, the DMs? What's kind of the way to make these partnerships happen?
Yeah, it's kind of, like I said, it's an emerging market right now where I think it's just getting bigger. So there's quite a few companies popping up that are trying to help people connect creators with influencers. And so we've gone through 2 or 3 different programs. And some of them have been total flops, and others of them we feel like are a better fit for us. We use one called Upfluence, didn't work. We use one called Coley, which we've kind of stuck with the time being. It basically, it helps you see all the, you know, basically the different channels that that people are posting on. You create kind of a campaign. So we say, hey, we have this cool bag. Or if you're interested in posting, let us know. And then people like the campaign and they say, I'm interested. And then we get a filter through the influencers and say, I want to choose you, you, and you. And so there's that program. And then we've actually heard of a couple others that we're doing demos with right now. It's like I said, it's a code we're trying to crack. So I don't have any knowledge to say this is the one you have to use. And this, but for right now, like Coley, we've done a couple campaigns for that and it's worked pretty well. And I know we're starting to expand into a couple other programs to try to make them work, but we'll see. Hopefully we can crack that code. If we can, like you're saying, I think it is scalable in that there's enough people who have enough followers that even these, you know, whether it's a micro or a macro influencer, it doesn't have to be someone that has like 10 million followers. I think it can be someone that has 100,000. And there's a lot of those people out there that have followers, people in different markets. And so that's the goal, is if we can crack that code and find a way to just tap into the right demographic and we can get the right people posting for us, I think it can make a huge difference.
Yes. And when you do, we're going to have to do a recap episode on how that works.
I'd love to. Yeah.
All right. So John, I'm going to transition over to a few of my frequently asked questions now that we're getting close to the end of our time here. So, you know, first off, what's your number one piece of advice to someone listening today that wants to build their own product and grow it into a profitable side business? What should they focus on?
Oh, man. So, man, I would say you have to be willing to work hard and just know that. I would say for anyone who's wanting to make it happen, you just have to be willing to take that step. For me, it took a little bit of capital. So, you know, if you kind of just have to set that goal for yourself to say, all right, once I have, you know, $40,000 in the bank or something like that, to just say, this is my number where I can live off of this. And then you just have to take that leap of faith to just say, I'm going to do it. And a lot of people, you would not believe how many people I talk to on a daily basis that just say, oh man, I envy what you do. I wish I could do it so bad. I've always wanted to be an entrepreneur. And you just hear people say that and it kind of makes you sad, because in my mind, I'm thinking you totally could, like, just go do it. Mm-hmm. Right? What's stopping you? So if it's a number, like, figure out what that number is and, you know, start working really hard to get there. But whatever that is that's holding you back, you know, isolate that and then just say, all right, once I hit this milestone, I'm going to just do it and just jump in. Cause you know, it's hard. There's hard days, but in the end, like, the reward outweighs all of the stress and the hard work that we had to put in up front to make it all happen. So that's probably my one piece of advice, is just don't be afraid to jump in.
That's great advice. I love it. You know, touching on a similar note here, what kinds of sacrifices have you had to make in order to put enough time and effort into growing your business over the years?
The number one thing is probably, yeah, just hobbies. Like, people often ask me, like, what do you do for fun? And I'm just like, you know, I'm finally starting to, like, get hobbies again. But for the first, like, 3 years of growing this business, it was like, I didn't think about anything else. So it was like the second I had any free time, I would just pull my laptop and start cranking, because it just had to. I mean, you have to. I was working at, you know, 20 to 40 hours outside of a full-time 40-hour job. And so it just gets, it's a lot of work up front. And so time, you know, you sacrifice a lot of hobbies. You can't just sit on the couch and watch Netflix and let your mind, like, unwind. You kind of just have to, like, grind and just keep going. And so I would say that's been hard. But yeah, probably number one thing I've had to sacrifice is personal hobbies. But now, like, the company is humming along. We have employees that are helping in a lot of areas. I'm able to, like, you know, I'm able to actually pursue some things that I like to do. So
yeah, it's paying off.
Yeah.
Do you have any particular strategies, tactics, ideas you guys have tested that come to mind as having ended up being a failure?
Well, that's a good question. Strategies we've tested that have been failures. Let's see.
Or maybe things that you would tell people to avoid trying.
Yeah, maybe I'll talk to one of our biggest pain points that we've had, which has been shipping. If you're creating a product, you know, a couple of key pieces of advice would be create something that's light, that's easy to ship, that's small, that you can package easily. Because when you get into heavy things, heavy and big things, you're basically shipping air at that point, and it can get really expensive really fast, and the returns and those kind of things can really come back to haunt you. So, you know, this is speaking from experience from a different business that we were involved with, but, you know, with our wallet campaign, there was this time where we said, all right, we've got, you know, we can ship from China and save a couple $1,000s, or we can ship from, you know, the United States and yeah, it would be more expensive, but there's a good chance it'll get there. Better. We ended up shipping from this carrier at Hong Kong Post in China, and this is like straight from our factory to our customers, and we lost like close to 1,000 wallets of the 7,000 wallets were just lost. And for some reason it happened to be along the East Coast, and I was maxing out my email every single day. I was sending close to 500 emails a day, just trying to respond to these customers that were so frustrated. And so that was one of the scariest, like, biggest points in the business where it was like, what did we do? We should not have done that. So I'd say, know your shipping, like, make sure you trust the shipping partner you're working with and that they, you know, can back up their claims of ship times and ship costs, those kind of things. That's been a huge issue for us in the past. And we finally feel like we figured it out, but it took 3 years to get there. So that's one you could spend some time up front just doing some initial research and making sure you've got that down.
Yeah. I mean, it's something that can seem so insignificant too if you're not digging into the actual research.
For sure.
All right. Well, John, this is my last question for you. What's been the best investment you feel you've ever made in the context of growing your business? And this could be in the form of time, money, tools, products, services, or otherwise.
Learning Facebook ads was the best investment. So we, you know, a year into our business, or I guess roughly, actually 3 or 4 months into the business, I jumped out of my full-time job and I just said, I'm going to learn Facebook. And that was like, I dedicated myself to that. I met with some local people that knew what they're talking about. They showed me what they did, set up a campaign for me. And then I was like, all right, I've got it. And at that point, I was able to grow our Facebook ad campaigns quite a bit. And like I said, we drove about 2 million in sales that first year. But then I realized I was reaching a point where I didn't know, I had to reach out and find someone who was better than me. So we ended up hiring a full-time guy that was at a local agency. He was the head of marketing there. And so that was kind of the next step. And so we were just investing in advertising. For us, that's what made all the difference in our company. It was able to help us grow, was just having the paid ads down. And you know, Facebook is one example, but I'm sure there's future channels that will pop up, you know, that will become popular to advertise on. And I would say when you hear about someone killing it, like, make sure you go out of your way to like figure out what they're doing, because if you can jump on early on, then you get to ride that wave like we have with Facebook, and it's really just made our company what it is today.
Always experiment. I like it.
Yeah.
John, well, thank you for joining us. Can you tell everyone listening where they can learn more about you, Nomadic, and everything you guys are up to?
Yeah, awesome. So you can see all of our products at nomadic.com. That's nomatic.com. And we are live on Kickstarter right now. We've got a bag that's going to end in the next couple of days. So that's a 30-liter travel bag. It's a pretty awesome bag. So you can go check out the products we offer. A lot of cool stuff. So thanks for giving me time today. I really appreciate it, Ryan.
Beautiful. Thank you again for joining us. If you enjoyed this episode of the Side Hustle Project, I would love your support. Head on over to the Apple Podcasts app and give us a rating. And as always, you can catch every episode of the Side Hustle Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for tuning in.